BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Well, it's here, folks. It's finally here. When did we start talking about this? How many months ago did we start talking about Oregon, Ohio State, Autzen Stadium? A chance for a record crowd on Saturday. I think it is going to be a record crowd. We're going to talk about that, by the way, because I've got a conspiracy theory about the state of Oregon and attendance records. I might pick on somebody today. But we've been waiting. We've been waiting months and weeks and hours, and now we are down to days. We are down to days before Oregon and Ohio State kick it off at Autzen Stadium. And already, I've got some Oregon fans creeping into my email asking me, hey, if they lose the game, God forbid, what does it mean for the playoff? I got news for you. It doesn't mean all that much. And that's probably a good thing. I think in prior years, we've seen games like these become elimination games. When there's only two teams fighting for a BCS bid or a playoff spot, or four teams competing for four playoff spots, games like these tended to be elimination games unless it was so compelling and so good that it made the playoff committee sit up in their chairs and go, wow, I'd like to see more of this. I'd like to see these teams again. But I think with this expanded 12-team playoff, we're going to see a number of teams that have a loss. We're going to see a number of teams that have two losses still make the playoffs. And we'll probably even see a three-loss team get into the playoff. I looked back in the last couple of years. I went back to 2019. So that's what, five, six years of looking at the playoff final rankings and who was in the top 11. And I found six cases of three-loss teams in the last 5 years that have qualified for the playoffs. So it's right around one a year, maybe a little more. There were two in 2022. None would have been last year, but in 2022, you would have had two teams that qualified for the playoff with three losses. So this game in context of the playoff doesn't mean that much, but it also means everything, doesn't it? Because it's an opportunity for Oregon playing at home against a team that is traveling east to west. And by the way, the teams that are going across the country right now, whether it's west to east or east to west, not faring well. My pal John Wilner pointed out that the nine teams that have gone a certain distance or that great distance going across several time zones, the records of those teams are 1-8. And Miami almost became the ninth casualty on Saturday night in what was a terrific game, highly compelling game, at least, between two teams that left a lot of controversy. We're going to talk about officiating on today's show. There's a lot of bad officiating going on, or at least the perception is that there's bad officiating. I talked to a conference commissioner over the weekend, and I said, we're more discerning as sports fans, that we tend to recognize and know the rules, or we think we know the rules as well as the officials? Is it that we have instant replay? Are we spoiled by the fact that we have, 12 camera angles in some of these stadiums and maybe not so many in other stadiums? Is it because, we're in a era of mistrust? What is it as it pertains to everybody believing that the ACC officials are out to get, anybody who's playing Miami, or that the Big Ten officials have certain teams that they prefer? And, longtime officials that I know, or umpires that I know, people like Jim Joyce or Dale Scott, they kind of wave that all off as, the public will be the public. But I'd really love to dive into officiating on today's show as well and have you tell me what you see out there and why you think it becomes such a lightning rod issue come Saturday night, come Sunday, as we talk about the college football games of the weekend. 503-417-7575. Has the officiating deteriorated, or has our level or tolerance for mistakes by officials become, a lower tolerance? Or is it something else? Is it instant replay? We have too much information now. We can see it all. You tell me what's going on out there as you see it. Targeting, not targeting. Before we get caught into that with Cal football, can we address the idea that they failed to cover a receiver, the other team's best receiver, on a key drive late in the game with, you know, Cam Ward obviously going to put the ball in the air? Why is Cal's defense not defending Miami's best receiver? It was mind-numbing to me. And yes, I think it was targeting, but I also think Cal did so much wrong that before we can get to the officiating, we got to talk about that. I thought it was a great show for the Pacific time zone in particular over the weekend. I mean, Cal had that great turnout for ESPN College Game Day. It just kind of bothered me a little bit that the broadcasters on game day seemed so surprised at the rabid fans in Berkeley who showed up to support the team, almost like they thought nobody was going to show up. And yet Cal students showed up, Cal fans showed up, Cal alumni showed up. I know a number of people who went out there in the middle of the night because I grew up in the Bay Area, and went out there in the middle of the night because they were like, hey, they may never come back. I just think it was kind of absurd for ESPN to act like the Pacific time zone in the western part of the United States doesn't have great fans. And also, by the way, to wait until the ACC, an ESPN partner, has the media rights on Cal and is carrying the game, to come out and say, okay, this is worth us showing up for. I mean, it's further evidence of why when you do your media rights deals, Pac-12 take note, that having ESPN or Fox behind you or both behind you is a huge advantage over not having them. The shoulder programming, the decisions that are made, the narrative that gets cast, people saying, you know, suddenly Cal football is worth a damn. And, you know, I'm going, hey, what about the Aaron Rodgers era? What about Marshawn Lynch? Jeff Tedford had some really good Cal teams. Cal probably deserved to get game day decades ago. And now here comes Pat McAfee and here comes Kirk Herbstreit and the game day crew suddenly putting Cal on the map and saying, you know, it matters now. And look at all these people who've showed up. And, you know, that was always true when Cal was in the Pac-12 as well. As I said, great showing over the weekend on the western part of the United States is Ashton Jeanty, the running back at Boise State, ran wild again. And I think the best part of his Heisman campaign is the fact that he is fueling his Heisman campaign. It's not a network. It's not the school's sports information department. This isn't an NIL deal. This is just a running back who is now over 1,000 yards after 5 games played, 16 touchdowns, averaging better than 10 yards a carry. And it's not like he's running through giant holes for 70-yard touchdowns that he doesn't get touched on. He's breaking tackles at the line of scrimmage. He's breaking a tackle at the second level. He's out running linebackers. He's breaking a tackle in the secondary and diving into the end zone. I've seen it multiple times. And the fact that the guy rushed for 190-plus yards on 16 carries is just further evidence that if I had to cast my Heisman vote right now, he would be at the top of my ballot. We'll see where he ends up, but western part of the United States getting it done. How about Washington beating Michigan over the weekend? Again, another team traveling across multiple time zones and struggling. Washington getting a fair measure of revenge, good for the Husky fans. High five to Jed Fish, the Washington coach. They got it done in what really felt like a must-win game as the weekend approached. This was the kind of game where if Washington's early part of their season was going to be worth a damn, you had to kind of get this game. USC, UCLA didn't deliver. Oregon took care of Michigan State, though, on Friday. You all saw it. Jonathan Smith's return, a lot of people buzzing about the point spread as Michigan State kicked a field goal at the end. backdoor cover, meaningless field goal, people sort of going, well, wait a minute, did Jonathan Smith know what the spread was? Did he do that intentionally? Does somebody have a bet on the game? I don't think Jonathan Smith is wagering on the game. Conspiracy theorists, please stand down. But I do think they're aware of the point spread. I do think they're aware of trying to make the game and the score look as respectable as possible. If I'm Michigan State, this becomes a, hey, let's get the field goal, let's get the extra points moment, rather than, try on fourth down and end up coming up empty. Don't blame him for that. Also think it was evident in watching Oregon. This was the first time Friday night that I felt like Oregon could beat Ohio State. It was the first time all season that I watched Oregon. I went, gosh, could they beat Ohio State? Gosh, if they play like this. But, man, Jordan Birch, the defensive front seven, they dominated the line of scrimmage on both sides of the ball, ran the ball well, defended Michigan State. Michigan State could not run on Oregon. I compared the numbers in the first half because that's the half that really counts. You know, everybody's playing at full strength. And I looked at the first half of the Ohio State-Michigan State game 6 days earlier, first half of Oregon and Michigan State, and it was the first time statistically and personnel-wise, eyeballs on the game that I felt like, hey, gosh, if Oregon plays like this, they're right in this game with Ohio State. To this point, I've kind of wondered. There is a question, I think, in Eugene, and the biggest question for me is Dylan Gabriel. And I know he's won big games. I know he's got a ton of starts. I know that he beat Texas last year, 15 seconds to go in the game, throws a touchdown pass. He ran for 90 yards in that game. He threw for, 250 plus. It's a great game by Gabriel. His coach after the game was declaring, he's very calm. He's very poised. This is the guy. But I haven't seen that from Dylan Gabriel at Oregon. And I still didn't even see it on Saturday. On Friday night. It's the one question I think Oregon's got to answer in this Ohio State game. And if I'm Ryan Day and I'm Ohio State, I am going to say to Oregon, make Dylan Gabriel beat me, because he does not look comfortable. He's making some mistakes, particularly in the red zone. Looks like he's pressing a little bit when they get in the red zone. Dan Lanning makes the comment in the post game. Says, we took the decisions out of their hands, meaning we just decided we were going to run the ball and to hell with it. We're not going to screw around with throwing the football. I just thought it was a really affirming win for Oregon on Friday night in a lot of ways. And then the lingering question, and I wrote this on Friday night, is Dylan Gabriel the guy? And I he's not Bo Nix, right? I mean, I think it's unfair to expect that he is Bo Nix. But can Dylan Gabriel get comfortable in Will Stein's offense, and can he stop making mistakes in the red zone? And it's such a hard thing because he's on his third school. He's only been in Eugene for months, a matter of months. He's got to very quickly figure this out. I think he'll get there by the end of the season, but Ohio State's not waiting. Here comes Ohio State on Saturday. I'll give my official pick for the game on Thursday, but I got to tell you, on Friday night was the first time I looked and I went, you know what? I kind of like Oregon a little bit. And I hadn't said that all off season, all summer. I had kind of wavered with, can Oregon win this game? Rick Neuheisel told me at Media Day he likes Oregon to win the game. And I went, I need to see more. I might pick them. But Friday night was the first time I saw Oregon dominate the line of scrimmage on both sides. Looked like they figured out the run game, except for Dylan Gabriel. Like, I'm still left thinking, can you trust him in a situation where you need him to go win the game? Or will he press and make a mistake? So I want to talk about those two things off the top of the show at 503-417-7575. Do you trust Dylan Gabriel? Do you think something's wrong there? Or is it a matter of, hey, he's just a guy getting used to a new system and pressing a little bit? It worries me that he's made the mistakes against UCLA and Michigan State. In five quarters, he threw three interceptions. All three were in the red zone. That's 21 points that you're giving away in 2 weeks. You cannot give away points against Ohio State. So he needs to clean that up. But I want to know how you feel about it. I'm nitpicking. And I want to know how you feel about officiating. Are you seeing anything that looks different to you on the officiating front? Or is this just kind of as it always has been, and yet we have more information and more I guess, video evidence and maybe a less tolerance for mistakes or actions by the officials. It feels like there's less trust than ever for the officials who are on the field. 503-417-7575 is the phone number. Stephen Vaughn, coming off a big weekend. Let me go in this order real quick with you. Dylan Gabriel, trust him or not, or to what degree?
I can't say that I trust him, no, not yet. But I still think he can go out and win football games. I think he can make plays. But the two interceptions in the red zone against Michigan State, that makes me lose trust for you. And you can't have that against Ohio State. Against a team like Michigan State, that's fine. When you're going up against Ohio State, you're going to at least have to get points on that. Well, even if it's just a field goal, you can't give up nothing and just turn it over in the red zone. So for that reason, no, I can't trust him yet. But the pieces around him are still so good. The wide receivers are so good. The running backs are good. I have to say that it's not going to deter me from picking Oregon if I think Oregon's going to win this game, the non-trust factor with Dylan Gabriel.
Well, I think that trust factor is big. I think it could be the key to the game because I think Oregon and Ohio State, I'm eager to see because, you know, I don't think this is an Ohio State team that is capable of winning a national championship. Doesn't feel like that kind of team to me. I don't think they're quite as good as some of those teams in the past, but it's a team that is, I think, obviously going to compete for the conference championship. And, you know, whoever gets that conference championship and gets that first round bye in the playoff is going to be sitting prettier than ever. Let's go to the phone lines. Come back to you, Stephen. Roy's in Portland. Roy, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Hey, how are you doing, John?
I'm well.
First of all, I like to say to Alabama, you know, Alabama Super Bowl is playing Georgia, man. That's their national championship, you know. But I just like to laugh at you. Got beat by the worst. Vanderbilt probably has the worst facilities out of all the Power Four schools in the country. You lost to Vanderbilt.
What happened Roy? What happened there?
I think they weren't prepared. I think this is, you know, this is on Kalen DeBoer, because if Nick Saban was a coach, Nick Saban would have, it wouldn't be no way. I think they got so high on beating Georgia that they weren't taking Vanderbilt seriously, and Nick Saban wouldn't allow that. He wouldn't have allowed that. And I'm disappointed in Kalen, and I'm also disappointed in Jonathan Smith. I mean, Michigan State looked absolutely terrible, man. I mean, I'm sorry. That's a bad football team, and I expect more out of Jonathan Smith than that. I don't know if he got his guys in there or maybe, but that was a pathetic showing. You know, Ohio State and Oregon. I don't listen, John. I still think both teams haven't really played anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's like even. I don't trust Dylan Gabriel though.
Yeah.
But it's like, I don't trust Ohio State either. I don't know. I don't think Ohio State is good enough to win a national championship either. So I don't know about this game, man. I think they could be able to get to Gabriel, and he's the weakest link. I think if you get to Gabriel and turn him over, Ohio State will win. But I just can't decide this game, man. I don't know. It's even, and I'm watching the games this weekend, John. And I missed the old Pac-12, man. I just got to tell you that, man.
Yeah.
If the old Pac-12 was still together with USC and everybody, this would be a great season. I think this would be great. And the Cal turnout showed that they got lowballed in their TV contract with the what was the guy's name that was doing the negotiation?
George Kliavkov?
Yeah, Kliavkov.
Yeah.
I think he was just the wrong guy. But I missed the old Pac-12, man. I really missed that. I really miss it.
Yeah, I had that thought over the weekend, Roy, that there was nothing wrong with the conference. I mean, Cal's in there mixing it up with Miami. Oregon looks good. You know, Oregon State is beating Colorado State in double overtime. Good win for the Beavers. Washington State has a win over Texas Tech. Texas Tech beats... You know, the Big 12's a mess. You look at the top of the Big 12, and it's in everybody's beating everybody. You know, is it possible the Big 12's going to get only one team in the CFP? I mean, the way it's looking, if I'm the SEC and the Big Ten, I'm looking over at the Big 12 going, thank you very much. There, you know, Michigan loses to Washington. I left the weekend too saying, gosh, you know, we were told originally that the Pac-12 with UCLA and USC in it, Bob Thompson told us on this show that he thought with those teams in it, they would have got $500 million deal with their TV rights. It would have been about $41.6 million per school. Without those two schools, he said they were worth only $30 million. Yeah, 10 schools worth $30 million or 12 schools worth $500 million. It's about a 28% difference there when you factor it out on a per school basis. All the Pac-12 had to do was give USC and UCLA a larger distribution, and I think the conference would have lived to play another day. Let's go to the phone lines. Matt is in Fairview. Matt, welcome.
Hey, John. Just wanted to comment on Dylan Gabriel. Taking a look at him, Dylan Gabriel can be an insanely accurate passer, but yeah, he's definitely had trouble in the red zone, and so it's one of those things where it's like, do I trust Dylan Gabriel? Yeah, I trust Dylan Gabriel to get us down to the red zone, but you have to have that knockout punch in order to be able to do that. You can't be one-dimensional. So that's why he doesn't have my trust completely. He's about 85-90% there for me, because I have seen him just throw just insane passes to people that, like, he just, you know, threaded the needle. And I think that that's what he's just trying to do in the red zone. He's just trying to make too much happen. And I think if they can get him to calm down and settle down, then he'll be just fine. I just want to comment on Dan Lanning and his growth this year. I've seen him kick a lot of field goals. I've seen him not trying to run up scores, especially against, you know, Idaho, you know, and a couple of games where he struggled. Like, he centered the ball, kicked the field goal. Like, it seems to me like he's growing in that, and he realizes that he's going to need that moving forward. And it also feels a little bit more of a pro style of, you know, strategy to, you know, get the points and, you know, and kind of move on down the field kind of thing.
Yeah, I've seen it as well. And I think, you know, Oregon, you know, this weekend was the first time I've been pretty good all season with my picks. But this weekend was the first time I correctly called Oregon, and it was Jonathan Smith with the backdoor cover that helped me get there. I don't feel great about my, but all year I've been picking Oregon to cover the spread, and all year they've been letting me down. And then I think Lanning has been laying up a little bit and trying to make the right decision and trying to make, you know, I have the better team. I don't want to do anything squirrely kind of mentality, which is good. He needs to do that when he has the better team. He's going to be judged on games like the game this weekend, though. And he's going to be judged on his ability to beat Washington. Those kinds of games. All right, coming up, we're going to Columbus, Ohio. Bill Rabinowitz, Columbus Dispatch. He's joining us next. Dan Lanning's on Thursday at 4:20. I want you here Thursday for Dan Lanning if you want to check out the one-on-one interview with him. But Bill Rabinowitz in Columbus next. Leave it here.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
So this morning, I was thinking about guests for today's show that I absolutely have to have. And I was thinking, you know, I need to text Bill Rabinowitz of the Columbus Dispatch, because he is the guy who knows what's going on at Ohio State. It's the best conversation that we could have media to media about this football game. And I was just about to text him, and a text popped up on my phone from Bill Rabinowitz. You ever have that happen? Like, you're thinking about somebody. It's not like we text each other all the time. I was 10 seconds away from sending him a text, and he texted me. And Bill Rabinowitz is joining us now. What prompted that thought? Because I think it was telepathy. I think I sent you a message.
Well, I thought, who could I have on to discuss Oregon on my podcast but John? And I just have faster fingers.
You have faster fingers, indeed.
Playing guitar or something like that.
Hey, how's Ohio State feeling about this game? How are the fans? Let's start with the fans. How are the fans feeling about this game at Autzen Stadium?
You know, I always hesitate to speak for the fans because I really try to avoid, like, message boards and talk radio. I just do. I have enough to do with my job. So I wouldn't say I have the pulse of the fans, but I think I would say this. It's a game everyone's really looking forward to. Ohio State played three nobodies in the preseason, in the non-conference part of the schedule. Then Michigan State, which is not a contender in the Big Ten, and Iowa, which has half of a team, a very good defense and not much of an offense. Although Caleb Johnson is pretty good. But this was the game. October 12th was the one. Okay, this is when Ohio State will find out just how good they are. Of course, everyone knows Ohio State was supposed to play at Autzen 4 years ago, and the pandemic ended that, forced the cancellation of that game. Oregon came to Columbus the next year and whipped Ohio State. I mean, that was impressive by the Ducks. And so I think there's been a little bit of that, like, okay, when are we going to get a crack at them? And then when Oregon joined the Big Ten, obviously, we're gonna get that game finally.
Bill, the questions, I think, for Oregon right now, Dylan Gabriel's thrown three red zone interceptions, in the last two games. He looks like he's pressing a little bit. He doesn't totally look comfortable. That's a big question for Oregon. And, what are the questions for Ohio State right now?
Well, honestly, I don't think there are a lot of them. I think the biggest one, Ohio State entered the season with really two big question marks. One was quarterback, and Will Howard took control of that job pretty early in training camp. It was pretty clear that he was going to be the guy. And he's been everything Ohio State wanted him to be. Is he a talent on the level of C.J. Stroud? No, but, few are. He's been better than Kyle McCord, I would say, overall, and in part because he has a running dimension that Kyle McCord really didn't have last year, especially after McCord sprained his ankle in the Notre Dame game. So he can run. He's a willing runner. His passing has been good, especially on the shorter passes, medium-range passes, very good. Deep passes, a little more hit and miss. But Ohio State has phenomenal receivers. Emeka Egbuka is a terrific receiver. Jeremiah Smith is already, as a freshman, quickly becoming one of those guys that you just kind of say, oh, man. I mean, he's a highlight reel. Carnell Tate, who missed the Iowa game, they held him out. They expect him back. They have, this is one of the subplots of the game. Who has the better receivers? Now, Oregon, according to certain statistical categories, has the best receiving group in the country. I think Ohio State fans would probably say they would not trade the Buckeyes group for anybody. So that's going to be an interesting matchup. And the other big question mark, though, was the offensive line. And that was a big issue last year. It got exposed in big games. In the Missouri game and the Cotton Bowl, it was a disaster. But they showed against Iowa, which is a very good defensive front. Front 10 is very good for Iowa. That they opened holes consistently for Quinshai Judkins and Travion Henderson. And those two are really good running backs anyway. So that, to me, was the last question that I needed to have answered about Ohio State. Could that line play against a really good team at open holes consistently? And it did.
Bill, Chip Kelly, offensive coordinator, how has his move into the Buckeyes world maybe changed or put fingerprints on what they're doing offensively?
Yeah, I think he's probably holding some things back. I would expect him to unveil some things against Oregon. But there are like two or three plays a game that all from the press box go, oh, that's a Chip Kelly play. Maybe it's a misdirection or just a formation or a look that we haven't seen. And obviously Ryan Day is Chip Kelly's protege, and there's a lot of similarities in how they like to run their offenses. So it's not like a completely dramatically different offense. But you see little touches here and there. I think the run game effectiveness is a credit to Chip Kelly in part. Some of it's just those offensive linemen having another year of experience. That's a big part of it. But I think that there's a confidence in Chip Kelly's play calling that kind of bleeds through the team.
I am thinking about his imprint and, the fact that he's just getting to coach. It feels like that would be a big advantage with Tosh Lapoy and Oregon's coordinators being younger, less experienced. Is that being talked about at all?
Yeah, Chip Kelly came to Columbus to be the offensive coordinator because he wanted to just be a football coach. He didn't want to deal with all the stuff he had to deal with as a head coach anymore. And Chip Kelly is probably not built for that, right? I mean, it's just not who he is. But the guy who's kind of drawing plays on a napkin, that's what he loves to do. And he has a guy who encourages that in Ryan Day, and he has all kinds of talent to work with. So I think he's having a ball, honestly. I think he's, when he's talked to us, and I know, like, when he was the coach of the Eagles and the 49ers, that some of those, he just seemed uncomfortable in some of those media settings. He's really comfortable here. I mean, he'll crack jokes and just be very, very kind of, he seems happy. I mean, it's such a simple word, but he really just seems happy. And, you know, he's 60 years old. He doesn't need the money. The pay cut to go from a head coach to a coordinator is no big deal to him. He just wants to enjoy his job, and I think he really is. And I think that Ohio State's really happy to have him. Obviously, that was it's a weird deal because Bill O'Brien had been hired as the offensive coordinator and then took the Boston College job. And so, you know, it kind of left Ryan Day in a lurch, but Chip Kelly was, that's a hell of a bailout.
Oregon has been talking about this game. Everybody's been thinking about this game since the schedule came out. I can't decide if that's good or bad. You know what I mean? Like, you know, is it good or bad that this has been the focal point? I do know that how this game gets played is going to matter. Like, I don't think the loser's out of the playoff race by any stretch with 12 teams in the playoff. But I think if it's a really good, compelling, close game, we may be looking at a rematch. How do you see winning this game or losing this game kind of affecting Ohio State's psyche right now?
Well, it's funny. In fact, Joey Kaufman, my beat department, and I do a roundtable, and one of the questions that we decided to go to tackle was about what this game means. And what I said is that the winner of this game, I mean, if it's Ohio State, I'm speaking from the Ohio State perspective, it's almost a guarantee to get in the playoffs. Because I think a two-loss Ohio State team is in. I think a two-loss Oregon team is in. You know, Ohio State only really plays three tough opponents. They play at Oregon, at Penn State, and then Michigan. You know, Indiana's obviously had a great start, but I don't think they're a real threat to beat Ohio State. The other one is Nebraska. You know, I mean, I'm impressed with Nebraska's better, but I don't think they're ready for Ohio State. And so even if Ohio State were to lose to Penn State and Michigan, and I don't think they will, but they could. I mean, they certainly could. And if they beat Oregon, I think a 10-2 Ohio State team is in. And so in past years, a game like this would leave you with no margin for error. If you lost this game, because no two-loss team ever made the 14 playoff. So if you lost this game, you had no margin for error the rest of the year. That's not the case anymore. So a loss, you know, obviously is not good. But as you said, they could very well meet again in Indianapolis in December. Because I look at the Big Ten, and I think it's really a three-team race right now, you know, Penn State being the third. It's early October still, so things could change. But I think those three teams have really set themselves apart.
I am looking around. We saw a bunch of upsets last Saturday, and you know, it was all those teams in the top 10 that got caught. What do you think's going on there, Bill? Is it bad rankings? Have the teams mentally, you know, does a team like Alabama know they have a mulligan? I mean, I can't decide, you know, is there more parity? Do you have a theory?
Not really. I Ohio State was playing at the same time as Alabama, so I was kind of looking at the score. I saw Vanderbilt was up 13-0, and then, you know, I've got a game to cover. I can't be looking at that game, and I see that they're still ahead. I'm thinking, there's no way Vanderbilt's going to hold on and beat Alabama. It's just not going to happen. And we're doing the interviews in the post game, and I see somebody says, Vanderbilt beat Alabama. I'm like, oh, and you're kidding. I don't know what happened in that game because I didn't see it. But, I mean, maybe the fact that it's not March Madness, as Ryan Day used to say, where every game was an elimination game. Maybe a team like Alabama realized, you know, it's Vanderbilt. Well, we can coast through this one. I don't know. Maybe Vanderbilt's a lot better. I mean, they did give Missouri a game. So I don't know. I like the 12-team playoff. I think it's better for college football to have more teams to have a chance because it was a monopoly. Let's face it. It was Georgia and Alabama and Ohio State most years, and then you'd have, you know, Clemson obviously and some other elite programs, but you very rarely had, you know, the TCU year. You know, Michigan State made it once, but for the most part, it was like a closed club. And now it's it's 12 teams. And, you know, if you take care of business on the field, you're going to get in it.
Bill Rabinowitz, Columbus Dispatch, with us. You've seen a number of big games for Ohio State in your time covering being on the beat. How does this Oregon game stack up to, you know, maybe some of the big regular season games of the last few years? Or has it just been Michigan, Ohio State mainly? Or does it even come close to a Michigan, Ohio State game with the stakes?
I'll be honest and I'll say no. Because Ohio State, Michigan is its own entity. Even if the teams aren't even very good, and they usually are very good, the game means a lot. So, I mean, we've had this discussion. Would an Ohio State fan feel completely happy with a national championship if Ohio State still lost to Michigan that year? If Ohio State lost to Michigan, won the Big Ten, won the national championship, would there be a certain amount of, like, I don't think hollow is the right word, but, you know, a tiny bit of an asterisk to it? I think there would be some Ohio State fans, probably not the majority, but some who would say, yeah, you can't call this an unqualified success because you still lost to Michigan. So I don't, you know, I know Oregon State is big. I know Oregon, Washington is big. Unless you are here in Ohio or in Michigan, I just don't think it's possible to really understand how much that game means. You know, it's the last game of the regular season every year. The hatred is real. You know, the Connor Stallion stuff and the Jim Harbaugh stuff that's just added to it, Ryan. I mean, this game this year, no matter what Michigan ends up doing in terms of turning their season around, is going to be incredibly intense. So I think Ohio State fans view this one as more of a fun game. I mean, they certainly want to win, and it's important, and they have a lot of respect for Oregon, but it's not life or death like Michigan is.
Bill, the Oregon offense has, you know, looked okay. It had a couple of moments in the early part of the season against Idaho and Boise State where you kind of wondered about the offensive line. They've seemed to have figured that out. How is Ohio State's front seven? And you know, you got to see them a little bit against Iowa and some others, but how does that group match up against an Oregon offensive line that may have some question marks in its past?
Yeah, I watched the Oregon-Michigan State game, and I was impressed with Oregon's running game. Jordan James, I thought, was very good. Ohio State's front four is really, really good. Jack Sawyer, JT Tuimoloau, Tyreek Williams are all possible first-round picks. Ty Hamilton's an underrated guy. He'll be drafted. They have backups who could start for almost anyone in the Big Ten. Caden Curry, for example, is a terrific player. The linebackers are, I would say maybe a notch below that. I mean, Cody Simon's the middle linebacker. He's a fifth-year guy, very, very solid, but probably not, you know, a superstar. Sonny Styles is a phenomenal player. He's making the adjustment from safety to linebacker, and he wasn't great against Michigan State, but he was really, really good against Iowa. Made some really good plays. The secondary is very good. Denzel Burke is a possible first-round pick. Davis Igbinosin, an Ole Miss transfer, came last year, is a really aggressive corner. Sometimes he'll get some interference and holding calls because he's so handsy, but he's a really competitive guy. And the best player, I think, on the whole team, honestly, is Caleb Downs, the safety you transferred from Alabama. He is, boy, he's good. I mean, you just notice him out there. Jim Knowles used the term, they activated him against Michigan State. It's like a video game guy. Okay, we'll activate him. He's incredibly instinctive, very fast. He's a real difference maker. So you look at that defense and you go, there are no real weaknesses on that defense. And, you know, of course they give up plays. Everyone gives up plays. But it's, you know, Ohio State's given up, I think it's like 27 points all year, something like that. And the Iowa was shut out until the backups came in and Caleb Johnson had a 28-yard touchdown run. But they did nothing against the starters. So it's going to be a challenge. I mean, it's going to be a challenge. Oregon has not seen anything like Ohio State's defense, and Ohio State's defense has seen nothing like Oregon's offense. So that's what's fun about it.
I spend all week kind of mulling what I'm going to do with my pick, and I make it on Thursday. Do you have a sense right now of, do you make a pick for the game?
We have to, and I hate doing it. I mean, I really do, because I don't have any more knowledge of it than anyone else. But I think if this were a neutral field, I'd feel pretty confident in Ohio State winning. I think having to make the long trip is an issue. I mean, what's the road games, road teams making that coast-to-coast trip are 1-8, I think, in the Big Ten. And so I think that's a concern if you're an Ohio State fan. I think Ohio State's got slightly better talent across the board. So I don't know. I think it's close to a toss-up game. I wouldn't be shocked if Ohio State won comfortably. I would be shocked if Oregon won big. I wouldn't be shocked if Oregon won in a close game.
Bill, I am going to go on your podcast, and I will see you at the stadium. It'll be fun. Have you ever been to Otz? You probably haven't, because you've covered...
I have not.
Yeah. Is that exciting for you, or, yes, or do you dread it?
I wanted to, well, I don't like the trip, but... I don't like, you know, flying that far, but I like it for a couple reasons. One, I've never been to Oregon, and I hear it's a wonderful state, a beautiful state. And I was looking forward to coming 4 years ago, and obviously that was canceled. So I'm looking forward to seeing Oregon, and I hear Austin's a great place to see a game. And just selfishly, my daughter lives in Oakland, and so after the game, I'm going to fly to see her for a few days. And so, you know, that's why I'm looking forward to the trip overall. But, I am looking forward to this. I mean, I'm not crazy about traveling. You know, everyone dreads traveling these days. But, you know, I'm interested to see Portland for a little bit and then drive down to Eugene. And I'm going to meet a friend and have dinner, I hope. And so it'll be fun. And the game should be great, right? It should be. I mean, I'm hoping it's a great game.
Yeah, I think it'll be a fun game. Bill, I appreciate you making time. I will be sure to say hi to you in the press box, and I'll talk to you on your podcast coming up later this week.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me on, John.
All right, there he goes from the Columbus Dispatch. He's the guy, Bill Rabinowitz. And look, I went out and covered the Big Ten 1998, 1999. I've been to Columbus. I've been to Madison. I've been to Ann Arbor, Michigan. I've seen those places. I think it's really interesting to hear those media members talk about coming west, like Oakland, California, being so close in proximity to Portland. While I'm out, I might as well go see my daughter. I love that he's going down to see his kid. But we often, right, we think about those things in different ways, don't we? I want you to tell me who you like in this game. What are the questions in your mind? 503-417-7575. Dan Lanning will be on Thursday's show in the 4 o'clock hour. Leave it here.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I don't know if times are changing or just coaches are changing, but Kalen DeBoer coming out today and saying that Malachi Moore, the team captain at Alabama, who had a really bad couple of moments at the end of Saturday's loss to Vanderbilt, is not going to be suspended. He is a fifth-year senior and a team captain. He shoves Vanderbilt's quarterback, takes his head and shoves it towards the ground at the end of a play late in the game, throws his mouthpiece, gets a 15-yard unsportsmanlike conduct penalty for kicking the football after the officials set it down. Alabama tried to substitute for him at the end of the game. He refused to come off the field. Kalen DeBoer came out and said that Moore has gone above and beyond in taking ownership for his on-field tirade and will not be suspended. Moore went on social media and said that was completely out of line with his actions. Nick Saban wouldn't have tolerated this. Other Alabama players are not happy about it, saying that they would have ripped the C off of his jersey, the captain C on his jersey, if that happened on their watch. Now, some of that might just be old Alabama players saying, this is what we would have done in our day. But some of it also might be a little fissure in the armor, so to speak. Is there a crack in the armor at Alabama? Is that what the loss to Vanderbilt was? Because, man, came out of that Georgia-Alabama game, and I went, Kalen DeBoer, such a good coach, wins everywhere. Is this Kalen DeBoer and Alabama taking over the world? And then here they go and lose at Vanderbilt and look pathetic in the way that they lost the game and lost their composure. And now I'm going, well, wait a minute. Like, you know, maybe there's a bigger question to be asked here. And maybe that was their Super Bowl, and Alabama won their Super Bowl and now is on to whatever else. Meanwhile, Oregon is hosting Ohio State. We'll take a quick one here from Michael in Oregon. Michael, quickly, you got to be fast.
John, going to be a great game on Saturday. I think the Ducks defense is the difference. I have not seen anything from Ohio State's offense that looks too scary, and that goes to hold only if our quarterback stops throwing the ball to the other team. But the defense this year is better than it was on last year's team, and that's what we wanted to see from Lanning. Yep. So it's going to be a great one, buddy. See you down there.
Yep, appreciate that. I will be there at Autzen Stadium. We'll have Dan Lanning on Thursday's show in the 4 o'clock hour. I hope you're here for it. Next, though, we're going to a lawmaker who says that the Big Ten and the SEC need to hear the saber rattling going on at Congress. Michael Baumgartner coming up.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Over the years, we had Mike Leach, the late Mike Leach, on this show often. And a few times we talked about the leadership in football strategy and war course that was put on by Mike Leach and a close friend of his. And you may remember Leach coming on the show and saying, hey, you know, insurgent warfare and football strategy, leadership lessons. That was the class that was co-taught by Mike Leach. And this guy, our next guest, Michael Baumgartner, running for Congress, state of Washington. He's a sports fan. And I guess, do we call him professor? Since he taught that class with Mike Leach. But got a big election coming up. He's running in the 5th District. I believe that's Spokane. Michael Baumgartner joining us now. What was it like to teach alongside Mike Leach? I got to know.
It was just a blast. You know, Mike and I, well, first off, John, thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate your program. Appreciate everything you do covering college athletics in the Northwest. But, you know, Mike was a fantastic guy. You know, we traveled to 10 international countries together and went and saw the Prime Minister of Cambodia on our very first trip. And as you might imagine, each and every moment you spent with Mike Leach was more interesting than last. And someday I got to write a book about it because there's too many good stories to share.
How did people react to him? And I got to, you know, as you travel around, I think when you're stateside, people probably recognize him. But you're in Cambodia and other places. I don't know if they know, you know, this is the former football coach where, or what did he do? Air raid? What is that? I mean, the reactions that he elicited from strangers.
You know, Mike was such a naturally intellectually curious person and such a naturally good guy. You know, he always had time for everyone that ever was interested in talking to him. I remember one time we were in Tanzania and, you know, Mike liked the late hours conversations, but sometimes I would have to go check on him in the middle of the night just to make sure that he had gone to bed because Mike could stay up at all hours. And one time in Tanzania, he was up all night talking to a Tanzanian bartender about country and Western music. And he later wanted to send him a cowboy hat. And this is when he was at Mississippi State. We were traveling together, and he told me that, you know, the cost of shipping the cowboy hat to Tanzania cost him like $1,000 or something. It was some ridiculous price to ship it over there, but he was bound to determine this Tanzanian bartender was going to get a cowboy hat to go with his country and Western music. But Mike was just a fantastic human being.
How did those classes go? Because Leach is talking football, and he also is a big history buff, but you have a background not just as a lawmaker, but you were in Iraq, you were part of the strategy in working with the United States and the embassy there and coming up with a security plan in Baghdad. And so how does that How did that all fit together when you guys are teaching a course?
Well, you know, when I first met Mike, you know, I had been used to working with David Petraeus, who, you know, David Petraeus would be like Nick Saban, which would be, how do you fight? David Petraeus was the commander of American forces in Iraq. And it would be like, how do you fight in conventional when you have all the 4 and 5 star equipment, you know, the heavy tanks, the air cover, you know? And Mike, the more I got to know him and we thought about the class, was Mike was like Ho Chi Minh sitting out in the jungle. Like, how did you fight when you didn't have the advantages? So how could you use something like the air raid to beat 4 and 5 star recruits with 2 and 3 star recruits? And that was really where we saw the overlap, was how do underdogs fight and win. And Mike, of course, was the ultimate college football outsider and non-traditionalist, but really did revolutionize the game with the spread offense and his air raid. And so, yeah, it really fit together well about, you know, how do underdogs fight and win and how do you stop them. And so it really dovetailed well with what I had done when I was working in Baghdad and in my background in counterinsurgency. And so we do, and the class was just a scream. You know, we had Jack Thompson, the throwing Samoan, come in. We had guys that had stopped the Unabomber or arrested the Unabomber. We had survival specialists. And it was just fantastic. And, you know, we had something like, I think, 50,000 people interested in attending the course. And, you know, my only regret is that, you know, Mike passed away untimely. His untimely death kept us from doing it again.
Michael Baumgartner with us. You've got a long, illustrious career as a lawmaker, and now you are running for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 5th Congressional District. That's Spokane, isn't it? Isn't that in the Spokane area? Or tell us how that works.
Yeah, about 72% of the district is in Spokane County.
Okay.
So we go all the way from the Canadian border up north all the way down to Walla Walla. Of course, have Wash State University, my alma mater, for undergraduate in the district, as we do have Gonzaga and Eastern Washington University. And, you know, I'm somebody that cares a lot about college athletics. My dad was a professor at Washington State University. You know, I'd gone to WSU and then what I call the WSU of the East, which some folks call Harvard, to make sure they understand the WSU of the East. But, you know, and when I was in the state Senate for 8 years, had been the chair of the Commerce, Labor, and Sports Committee, and had, you know, very much have an interest if I am elected to Congress. And right now the Hill gives us about a 95% chance of winning, but you know, fixing college athletics to make sure that it has a sustainable future for schools like Washington State and Oregon State and EWU is really a priority of mine.
What has the mood been since the announcement of Gonzaga in the Pac-12? I mean, you're sitting in the heart of that.
Yeah, I think people in Spokane are really excited. I talked to the Gonzaga University president the other day about it. They're very pleased. You know, I'm somebody that went to Gonzaga Prep, and then between WSU and Harvard, spent a year with the Jesuits in Mozambique. So very familiar with both universities, and I think it's going to be great for the economy of Eastern Washington. There's going to be a lot of interest in those games, and I think it's going to be great for our community. It's going to be great for the Pac-12, and so, you know, onward and upward. I think it's really exciting.
Give us an idea when you say, you know, the world of college athletics, and I really do. I think college sports, college football in particular, needs some oversight, or at least lawmakers to be aware of what's going on. Bigger fish to fry, sure. And people will always say, oh, we don't want Congress focused on college football. No, we don't. But we may need a little bit of attention there if this thing gets off the rails. Where do you see the role of a lawmaker as it pertains to college sports?
Well, I think it's incredibly important. Now, look, I mean, I remember when I was in the state Senate and the legislature found time to vote on the name of the official state oyster. So the idea that Congress doesn't have time to spend on something that's hugely impactful to our public universities and to, you know, our student bodies, I think that's ridiculous. I mean, it's a huge priority. The other great thing about college athletics, as America grows increasingly more politically tribal, college athletics is one of the few things that brings people together, regardless of whether they think themselves Republicans or Democrats or independents. So it is very important, and there are billions of dollars of public tax dollars at stake, and it absolutely needs to be elected officials that can be hired or fired by the voters who should be making decisions for these TV of these sports conferences and the future of athletics, not TV executives in back rooms or, you know, in this case, the House settlement was out today. I was just reading about, you know, I'm unimpressed with the settlement that came from this judge. That also should be something that should be decided by elected officials in their direct relationship with the voters. So, yeah, I would push back on anybody that says it's not a priority or that it doesn't matter.
when I think about the Big Ten and the SEC potentially squeezing out the other conferences, getting more of more automatic bids and more revenue for themselves, guaranteeing that, I see an attack on the free market. I see potential antitrust situations, and I have to think there would be numerous state lawmakers who would be interested in taking a deeper look at this. Is this something that is on your mind and maybe on the agenda if you get elected?
Yeah, I've already started some of those discussions. I was back in D.C. 2 weeks ago with other likely incoming members coming into Congress. And I think people do have a lot of concern with overturning the traditional amateur model of college athletics and the way consolidation is going. I always say we already have one NFL. We don't need two. You know, and so we need to make sure that schools like Oregon State, Washington State, Eastern Washington University are able, relative to their level, compete at the highest level of college athletics because it's good for their communities. And I will fight, and I will imagine that there are going to be a number of other members of Congress that will fight and push back against any efforts to create a segmented league. Now, it looks to me like the have schools are in a bit of a rush to separate themselves out. But we're going to push back on that. And it ought to be Congress that's making these decisions. Because at the end of the day, if you're unhappy with your member of Congress, you can hire or fire that person. I mean, you can't do anything as a general taxpayer with your university president or the TV execs that are making these deals. So, yeah, we're going to – the SEC and the Big Ten are going to find out. There's a lot more members of Congress from non-SEC and Big Ten schools than there are from those schools, and we'll work together to put together a coalition that makes sure that public tax dollars are being allocated responsibly in college athletics.
What kinds of things, what's the love language of those schools and those conferences and the university presidents who would be involved? How do you get to them in a way that is meaningful?
Well, you know, when I was in the state Senate, previous UW basketball coach Lorenzo Romar got mad at Gonzaga when Mark Few and the then WSU basketball coach in the early 2000s turned in Romar's assistant Cameron Dollar for illegally recruiting Josh Heupfeldt. And then so UW at that time decided that they didn't want to play GU in basketball. And I had read about a similar case in Kansas, where University of Kansas was big timing Wichita State, and the Kansas lawmaker had put in legislation requiring Kansas to play Wichita State, and they tied it to state tuition dollars. And I just introduced a similar piece of legislation requiring UW to play GU, and because it was important to the economy and there were public taxes. And I got a call from both presidents' office within 15 minutes. You know, at the federal level, Title IX regulation is what makes universities eligible to receive student federal aid dollars. And the legislation would be pretty straightforward, which is you would tie, via Title IX reform, you would tie the eligibility to get federal aid dollars for students to their certain requirements to have common sense in college athletics. And that would get universities' attentions very quickly. Also, because there just hasn't, Congress has been derelict on this issue, you basically have had a hapless NCAA trying to deal with this as a member-funded organization, but without the oversight of Congress. And there is a lot of past precedent of Congress stepping in when needed. You know, right now, Congress grants antitrust exemption to professional sports. That's how you can have a salary cap, so they can have competitive balance. And also, Congress was involved when college football was going to be declared illegal or fold up, and when Teddy Roosevelt and Congress stepped in to save college football back about 100 years ago. So there is precedent, and I think we'll find, you know, I'm not in Congress yet, but if I am able to get there, I think we'll find that folks are going to be interested in fixing this issue because it has huge public policy ramifications.
We're talking to Michael Baumgartner. He's running for Congress in the state of Washington, 5th District, there in Spokane County. In the primary, you were the winner of the primary. So how do you attack this? Like you know, there's some insurgent warfare, football strategy. How different is that from campaigning?
You know, we use a lot of the same topics. I mean, with my friend Mike Leach, you know, I used to talk politics two or three times a week. Interestingly, you know, Mike was interested himself in running for office. We talked about that quite frequently. You know, funny enough, he was, while he was a conservative Republican, he also had a libertarian streak. And, you know, Mike was kind of jealous isn't the right word, but I think it annoyed him that Tommy Tuberville was a member of the U.S. Senate because Tuberville had replaced him at Texas Tech. And it just kind of bugged him. So Mike and I would talk about that a lot. But yeah, he's an insurgent. Look, you know, I'm a Coug. And so that makes me naturally an insurgent because we were always the underdogs in the Pac-12. And I know a lot of Beavs feel the same way, you know. And I would say to any of your listeners that care about college athletics, even if they're from Oregon, you know, check out VoteBaumgartner.com. If they want to support our campaign, they'll have, even if they can't vote for me, if they want to support our campaign financially or otherwise, they'll have an opportunity to help somebody that will fight for their school as well, too. But, yeah, there's a lot of insurgent, and that's part of the reason why Mike Leach and I got along so well.
All right, I'm going to play a Leach clip before I let you go here. I asked him one time whether he would want to be president, okay? Here's his answer to that question.
You know, the hardest thing about that job is getting that job. I think the hardest thing is getting that job. Would I want that job? Well, it's like anybody. I mean, it's like my job. You know, everybody sitting at home thinks they want my job. you know, and that's also a job like my job that everybody thinks they know how to do that job better than the guy that has it, you know. Would I want that job? Yeah, I think I would. Now, my suspicion is you know, if you threw some pixie dust my direction and I got it, I'd wish I didn't after about a month. But, you know, after I checked out all the stuff, did the museums, flew the airplane, you know, ran around Camp David, you know, went, you know, you could have all kinds of cool tours, you know, Washington and stuff like that. I mean, heck, you could even do a JFK mischief tour, you know, like this is, you know, this is the room where, you know.
Yeah.
And
there he was. You know what I liked about him, Michael, is that when I asked him the question, you could hear that, you know, he's thinking about it out loud. And he kind of just let you have a glimpse of what was going on between his ears.
Well, I know, John, he really appreciated your friendship with him, and he didn't like all members of the media, to say the least, but he always thought you gave him a fair shake and were interested, and so I appreciate that. You know, when we first went to see the Prime Minister of Cambodia back in 2018, you know, Mike was actually not surprising, but he was a great diplomat. He was really good in that environment, meeting the Prime Minister. To this day, if you were to go to the office of the Prime Minister of Cambodia and you look behind his desk, there would be a Washington State University footballs that says "Make Cambodia Great Again," signed by Mike Leach and Senator Michael Baumgartner at that time. So he was quite the character. But he would have been, you know, Mike had the kind of, you know, Mike was intellectually humble, you know, and one of the reasons that made him such a good coach is that because he fought he was not the football star that went into things. He was a guy that had a law degree, never played college football, and he grinded his way up from the bottom. I mean, you know his coaching journey. He coached at community colleges in L.A. He coached in Sweden. He started it, you know, in the middle of nowhere at tiny schools. And just, he earned everything he got fighting his way up from the bottom. And that's the American dream, you know. And so Mike was a bottom-up guy from in college football, and he would have been the same thing as a politician if he'd had that opportunity. So such a loss. I was very proud that we put him into the Hall of Fame at Washington State University a couple weeks ago when we routed Texas Tech. And nobody would have been a bigger fan of the Cougs beating the Huskies a couple weeks back than Mike. I still stay in pretty constant contact with his wife and with his oldest son, Cody, who's a football coach himself.
Michael Baumgartner, thank you. Good luck to you in the election coming up, and look forward to seeing what you do after you get elected.
Thanks, John. I really appreciate your program, and keep up the great reporting about the rebuilt Pac-12, and go Beavs to all your Oregon State listeners out there. Take care.
There you go. VoteBaumgartner.com if you want to see more about Michael Baumgartner. I think it's important to get lawmakers on the show. We have Senator Wyden from the state of Oregon on the show. Perhaps we will get Senator Michael Baumgartner on one day after November. He's running for Congress, and I think, you know, the SEC and the Big Ten, they're obviously trying to see what they can get. I don't know who else would hold them accountable, but, you know, maybe the ACC, the Big 12, Pac-12, others will align themselves and provide a check and balance, or maybe it will come down to lawmakers being willing to step up and go, hey, wait a minute. This is, we grant the NFL some antitrust exemptions. In exchange, the NFL makes some concessions that allow the Kansas City Chiefs to compete with the New York Giants. We will see what happens with college athletics. Baseball World Series coming on the horizon. Dodgers and Padres in a spirited series, playoff series. The great Lee Hacksaw Hamilton is going to give us the Padres side of the story coming up. Leave it here.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Padres, Dodgers, division series tied, one game apiece. Padres with a 10-2 win yesterday. They got a little chippy. We'll get into more of that coming up. But Lee Hacksaw Hamilton, he's the guy. You know that. You have been here to hear the interviews with Lee Hacksaw Hamilton over the years. Based in San Diego, California. He was the co-host of Hacksaw and Hayworth was known as, on the station, known as San Diego's sports leader. Hacksaw Hamilton, now writing, doing some radio appearances, whatnot. This is falling under the whatnot category. How are you, Hacksaw?
John, good to hear from you. Is it Tuesday yet? We got baseball Tuesday night, San Diego. This town has gone crazy. And what we saw Sunday night at Dodger Stadium was pretty crazy, too. It's been phenomenal what the Padres have become. It's been tragic what the Dodgers are right now. And to think that this thing could be over by Wednesday night is just, it's really hard to believe, just like it was hard to believe what we sat and watched on Sunday night. And the way the Dodgers reacted to the beating and the way the Dodger fans reacted, now the Padres responded. So this sucker's not over. I know it was only one win on Sunday night, but right now, everything as it relates to San Diego looks, with the arrow pointed up, everything relating to the Dodgers because of their issues is pointing down.
When you talk about issues, clearly fans lost their cool. Dodgers seemed to lose a little bit of their edge in this series. What did you see as those factors that you're talking about?
Well, this has been building for a long time. There's always been an inferiority complex. Padre fans, San Diego fans, this team's only been to two World Series and got run out of there pretty quickly. And the Dodgers have won all these division titles, and they have all the World Series rings, and they draw 4 million fans per game, and they have a $290 million budget. So it's just a very, very different mode of operation in a very, very different market. But that being said, the Padres have been building towards this, and they have to win this year or get to the World Series next year, because after that, they're going to fall off the cliff. They have traded their whole farm system away three times, and they finally built this roster. They have nobody left in the farm system that's ready-made to be a major leaguer. And within 2 years, they're going to have a bunch of 35-year-old guys with contracts going to run into their age 40, age 42. So if it's going to happen, it has to happen now. But I'll walk you through. And I think you and I chatted about this way back. When we got to opening day, the Padres had lost their owner, Peter Seidler, benevolent man who passed away in a bitter fight with cancer. When we got to opening day, they had lost their $60 million a year TV contract because of the collapse of Diamond Sports and Bally Sports and regional networks. And when we got to opening day, they owed Major League Baseball $40 million in luxury tax payments. And the people that took over the team to run it for the Seidler family announced they're taking the payroll down from last year's 223 down to 160. And I thought, boy, this is going to be tough. And what happened, GM went out and made three, four more trades, traded the farm system away again, and they put this roster together that is complete. And this team is focused under a new manager, and they have just won every type of game you can, come from behind wins, blowout losses, walk-offs, etc. Phenomenal pitching staff, very selfless team. Nobody strikes out on this roster, which means you don't have a bunch of rally killers. and they just put the ball in play, and anybody on that roster could beat your brains out and win a game for you, and that's what's happened in San Diego. The flip side of that is the Dodgers with their record payroll, and the Dodgers with an unbelievable human being, a once-in-a-generation guy in Ohtani, and the Dodgers with good guys like Betts and Freeman, but the Dodgers pitching staff has been destroyed by injuries, and that's the shocker of it all. The Dodgers, if you look at their roster, you say, that's a hell of a staff. They got so many guys hurt. They had 38 pitchers this year that pitched at the major league level, 38. At one point, they had 19 pitchers have been on and off the disabled list. I've had to use 12 different starting pitchers this season. They've had 7 season-ending surgeries. And the big money guys they gave all the money to are all hurt. And here's the Dodgers, despite a great offense, hanging on for dear life because who the hell are you going to give the ball to next? So Dave Roberts has his hands full. And then you take all that, you stir it up, and the Padres are dominating the series this season, beat them 9 times. And then you have the episodes at the stadium where the Padres made some unbelievable defensive plays and then kind of egged the Dodger fans on, and the Dodger fans lost their mind. So that's where we are going to Tuesday night. So it's been a long run since April. All of a sudden, we're all rejuvenated because of what Padre baseball has become. And suddenly the Dodgers now have the understanding the Padres are no longer scared of them. And the Dodgers now have to deal with the psyche that the Padres are inside their head. And the Padres are going to hit whoever you throw out there on the mound, and then we'll just see where it goes. So, I mean, it's fascinating how this thing has flipped.
We're talking to Lee Hacksaw Hamilton. Hacksaw, you know, when you look at Fernando Tatis, Manny Machado, I mean, you're right about the swagger. I mean, Tatis hit everything that was thrown to the plate, you know, and he did what he wanted with every pitch in game 2. And Machado sort of being the spokesperson for the team, he goes 1-for-5, but had some pretty strong words after the game. Like, you're right that I don't think they fear the Dodgers. And I think winning this series, you tell me if I'm wrong, you know, San Diego loses the Chargers. If they get this series, it feels like it means more to Padres fans than maybe Dodgers fans, even though there would be a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of talk about the payroll. I think the excuse is out there with the injuries to the pitching staff.
Well, there's lots of ways to look at it. In all essence, the Padres own San Diego. They did not own the team, the city, when the Chargers were here. This was an NFL city, and the Padres are an afterthought. And the Chargers had gotten better and better, and the Padres continued to disappoint. But then the owner of the Chargers turned his back on 55 years of loyalty and left. And the anger and the rage here is just terrible. Well, the ownership of the Padres had just come on board, the Seidler family, 7-8 years ago, took control and said, this is what we're going to do. Well, all owners coming in the front door have sales pitches. But Peter Seidler and his baseball people followed it up, and they got progressively better and better as they went. It is now a Padre city. And I had always told Peter Seidler, who I did not know, he knew me because he was a talk show freak. And he said, Lee, I can't wait to get on the 405 freeway at 4 p.m. and get stuck in gridlock so I can listen to your sports talk show on radio. And I didn't even know the gentleman. But everything he said came to be true. And the Padres, because they're so civically minded and because they own the marketplace now, this has always been a great baseball city. And I told Peter that. And I said, Peter, yes, there are Padre fans who are here, been here ever since the franchise was formed in 1969, and you made it to the World Series twice and got run out. But I said, the wild card thing about this market, maybe it's different in the Northwest, this market has people from a melting pot of everywhere. And I said, if you win, you will draw everybody that wants to come to a Padre game. And if you win, Red Sox fan, Dodger fan, Cubs fan, Mets fan, Pirate fan, they're all going to come see their teams play. So you're going to sell the stadium out. Well, John, at the end of the day of this season, 56 sellouts. At the end of the day, in a market of 3.5 million, they have drawn 3.3 million, all-time record. So, I mean, it's phenomenal. Everything has finally fallen into place after 8 years of trying hard with a kind of a rogue general manager. So, this year, next year has to be a World Series appearance because after that things are going to change again. But it's fascinating just to see. And now the whole country saw what happened Sunday, the whole country. And I think you'd agree with me, a lot of different facets of the nation hate the Yankees and hate the Dodgers because that's big market and that's luxury tax baseball and the best that money can buy. And the little guy has punched him in the mouth. So I think the TV ratings on Sunday probably going to be special, and we'll see Tuesday, Wednesday. I think the whole bloody world is going to watch just to see if the little guy can knock off the big guy, and everybody seems to dislike the big guy. That's my reading of the atmosphere right now.
Yeah, and I think Rob Manfred in baseball were thinking this is going to be the Ohtani playoffs, and here come the Padres looking to spoil that. We're talking to Lee Hacksaw Hamilton. Before I cut you loose, Lee, San Diego State to the Pac-12, that happens in your footprint. How excited are Aztec fans about finally getting admission to the Pac-12?
Well, if this, you and I had chatted about this prior on your show up there in the Northwest, you know, if this had been a different era, if the Ducks and the Huskies and the Trojans and the Bruins were part of this conference and San Diego State joined the fraternity, it would be electric. But sadly, it's not. There's no buzz at all. Football has not been a national name. It's not like Boise State's national name. They got a lot of work to be done. Basketball is very different. Obviously, they've got themselves a national brand. It's kind of unique what Brian Dutcher's been able to do. I think they're caught between a rock and a hard place. And I credit Oregon State, Washington State. You've written a lot about it up there. I credit them for having the fortitude to try to rebrand this thing and build it. But there's not a lot of people out there to build. And, you know, getting the top four from the Mountain West is okay. But please convince me this is not going to be Mountain West 2.0, because that's the feel it has. There's no buzz at all because there is no USC and Oregon and UCLA or the Washington Huskies. So it remains to be seen. I do like the acquisition of Gonzaga. If I was king, gee, I wish I could make a trade and pry BYU out of the Big 12 and bring them into the conference. Now you got more brand names joining your league. I still think, I might be a lone wolf on a street corner, and you can tell me I'm crazy and you wouldn't be the first one. I still think Cal Stanford are going to find their way out of the ACC and come back. And if this UCLA disaster in the Big Ten, because that program is football-wise has really fallen badly, if UCLA wakes up one morning and says, this doesn't work, and now if UCLA comes back with Cal and Stanford, with what they've added, now suddenly it's a very different conference. But to the long answer to your question, there's no buzz because we're not going to the Pac-12. This, you know, please don't tell me that this is not going to be reincarnation of the old Western Athletic Conference or NWC 2.0. So only time will tell.
Yeah, I think without New Mexico, Wyoming, San Jose State, it's a better conference. But it's not the old guard Pac-12 for sure. But I do think they're talking about and leaving seats warm, obviously, for Stanford and Cal, and potentially for whatever comes next in college athletics. I'm more concerned about 5, 6, 7, 8 years from now, Lee. If the Big Ten and the SEC get their way, it will be a, you know, 36-team league, and then everyone else fighting for breadcrumbs.
I think you're correct in your assessment. I also will add this addendum to your statement. When these TV contracts expire, most of these guys are on 5-year deals, these networks are going to come back and they're going to say, we're not paying $50 million per year to Mississippi State and Vanderbilt in the SEC. And we're not going to pay $50 million per year to Northwestern and whomever is the bottom feeder in the Big Ten. And we surely don't want to do that to some of the lower bottom schools in the Big 12. So I think the landscape is indeed going to change. Now, whether that's a reshuffling of schools leaving and going back to regional conferences, that remains to be seen, or whether there is a super conference of football. But this also is now tied into the fact that everybody is of the understanding the NIL is not working correctly, and the transfer portal has just been disgusting to have to watch, observe, and deal with. And these poor coaches, you know, the top four veteran football coaches in the Mountain West walked away from their jobs within 2 weeks last fall. They were so fed up with tampering and portal and all that. So there's going to be a reemergence and changes in college football. And when these TV contracts expire, I think that'll be the first domino that's going to change it. And we'll see what Charlie Baker and the NCAA is able to do in terms of an antitrust exemption, because that's what they're pitching Congress on, John, is give us control and authority to take control of the NIL and restructure the portal. There's got to be some sanity back into college athletics, because it's the Wild West, and I don't think it's good for college athletics and the student athlete. And this whole, all these guys that went to the Big Ten and all these guys that are playing the Big 12 and obviously the road trips to the ACC, This whole thing is absurd.
Lee Hacksaw Hamilton, good luck to your Padres. Talk to you down the road.
Hey, John, always great to talk to you and everybody in the Northwest. When you're done with the bald-faced truth, go to my website, leehacksawhamilton.com. And, of course, you can register to follow me on YouTube just like you are with John. John, always a pleasure to chat with you. Have yourself a good evening.
Thanks, Lee. There he goes. Hacksaw says San Diego State, no buzz about getting to the Pac-12. Padres-Dodgers exchanging barbs in the locker room. Oh, the NFL Players Association, they may cringe at the idea that baseball players were talking to media, meaningful conversations happening in the locker room after game two. Share some of that coming up.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I was really interested in this beef going on between the Dodgers and the Padres. It roped me in a weird way. Conflict does that, right, sometimes? Reality TV is built on, sort of the fabrication of conflict between entities. There's conflict in rivalries. I think it adds something to big games. And, of course, here come the Dodgers and the Padres, both in Southern California, two clubs built very differently. And in the end, you've got a Padres clubhouse that's got a little bit of a chip on its shoulder, and you've got a Dodgers team that is got an air of superiority about it. Manny Machado and Jack Flaherty at the center of the spat, Dodgers pitcher, Padres hitter. Machado mad. Flaherty mad. Both of these players being interviewed in the locker room, by the way, after the game, right by their lockers. Violation of privacy. The NFL Players Association would tell you this is not a conversation that should be happening, but I think it's an important one. And it struck me this morning as I listened to both of these athletes kind of explain themselves. Flaherty speaking as a Dodgers pitcher, Machado speaking as a Padres hitter. I left thinking, gosh, I'm sure glad media had access to these players. Here's Manny Machado at his locker.
Flaherty said that you threw a ball into their dugout, and that's what prompted him to start bargaining.
That I threw what? I throw balls all the time into the dugouts.
Into their dugouts?
Both dugouts. I mean, they have bad boys. You know, you throw the ball back in there. So, when you try to hit our best hitter, right, get him out. If you can't get him out, don't hit him, right? I mean, we don't go out there and we're not... You know, they got the best player in the game, right? Otani. We don't go out there and try to hit Otani. We try to get him out, right? Don't go out there and try to hit my guy.
Manny Machado saying, don't hit my guy. Fernando Tatis with a couple of home runs. Machado threw a ball towards the dugout. Says, you know, he was just throwing it over there. A lot of jawing as Flaherty struck him out a couple of times. Flaherty basically saying, well, I'll let him speak. Again, at his locker, where the NFL Players Association says these players should not be talking.
You should never get involved. There's no reason. There's no reason ever to throw anything at players, no matter what's going on. Like, there's no reason to get involved with it. Stay out of it. And whatever went on over there, they have every reason to be upset about it. Like, nobody... We should never feel like we're ever going to get anything thrown at us on either side. So fans should never be involved. They didn't like the pitch to Tatis. I missed in the first inning, and I threw the ball over the middle. I wasn't going to miss over the plate again, but I've got no reason to hit a guy there to start off the sixth, like, as good as he's been swinging the bat. But we're down in the game. I'm trying to go in for effect, and he didn't get out of the way. It hit him. Didn't try to go and hit him to try to lead off an inning or anything like that. That doesn't really make sense. Didn't go up near his head, nothing, just trying to push a guy off the plate. He didn't get out of the way. And sometimes that happens. They're upset about it.
There it is. I'll point these out or offer these up as exhibits A and B for the case being made of why locker room access is important. There are some in the Players Association in the NFL who would like to limit access to the locker rooms. Now, it may just be that the Players Association is trying to create an issue where there isn't one so that they have something to give when it comes to their next negotiation on the collective bargaining agreement. But as I mentioned last week when this first came up, lots of habits formed during the pandemic. One of them was suddenly media wasn't in locker rooms, wasn't in NBA locker rooms, wasn't around Major League Baseball clubhouses, wasn't in the NFL in the locker rooms. And I kind of wondered, would this, would there ever be going back? You know, when media came back, when the pandemic was over, would they allow media back in? The other leagues have mostly done that, and that's been fine. One of the rules for media is to serve as a conduit between the teams, the athletes, and the fans in the league. I've covered Major League Baseball. I've covered the NFL. I've covered college athletics. You go to a news conference, you get one kind of interview. It's kind of made for TV. The cameras and the lights are there. There's a lot of polish. You don't really get a conversation. You go into a locker room setting, you might be one-on-one with a player. It is your job to be there. It's where relationships are built. It's where trust is built. You can have a real conversation. It's not just you asking a question, player answering, next question. If you take away that access, you are distancing conversations like the ones you just heard Manny Machado and Jack Flaherty have with reporters. You are distancing those players from the public. They're not going to have that same interview or that same kind of, hey, here's what I was thinking. Help fans understand. Here's what I was thinking. Here's what he was thinking. Here's where I stand on this moving forward. This access that the Padres and the Dodgers allowed to media in the locker room on Sunday night have generated some interest in their divisional series. They have connected with fans, and they have accomplished something that is beneficial to their cause. Flaherty and Machado both feeling like, hey, I got this off my chest. I've been heard. Message has been sent. Now, I find it interesting. Like, this is a turf war with the Padres and the Dodgers. There's no way around it. Like, there's an interesting Southern California dynamic going on, and there is a difference between Dodger fan and Padre fan in Southern California. And I know I grew up with a diehard Padres fan. I hadn't heard from him in years, and he texted me last night, you know, unsolicited, got a text message from an old friend who offers up the idea that, you know, this series means the world to him. He says, I just watched the Padres crush the Dodgers. I mean, he wanted me to know. He's watching his team. And so I think it's cool that this series has got the stage right now. And Ohtani being part of it is nothing short of amazing. You've got Tatis and you've got Ohtani and you've got great players. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in games 3 and 4. But there's a responsibility here by the leagues. And there was a responsibility by the media members who were videotaping or recording those interviews at the locker rooms or writing about it later. You've got to be a professional. If somebody's changing in the background, you shouldn't be shooting a video. Don't be an idiot. There's a responsibility to be respectful when you're doing your job, any job. And by the way, I pointed this out last week, but all these team-held cameras that are rolling in the locker rooms as the players are celebrating and spraying champagne at the end of the season and the wild card round, and or the football coaches are giving away the game ball or making a big speech, and you know, nobody's talking about player privacy when the team held cameras are around. Everybody's jumping around and excited. The motivation here doesn't feel genuine to me. The motivation by the Players Association and the NFL or anybody that would say, hey, we don't want the locker rooms is a place of sanctity and we need in privacy, and we should not be prone to doing. No, your own team cameras are in there. What are you talking about, privacy? It feels like either the Players Association wants to control the narrative, or they're trying to manufacture a bargaining chip for the next round of negotiations. I kind of think it's the second one, because the baseball players aren't bellyaching about this. They're talking. Manny Machado's talking. He's happy to be talking at his locker. And the players will tell you that they prefer to have those conversations there rather than maybe in front of like TV cameras while they're wearing a suit in a more formal setting because it's more conversational. It's a real conversation. So Dodgers, Padres, decide what side you're on in that turf war. I always go with the little guy, so I'm kind of with the Padres. I'm rolling with the Padres in this series, but Shohei Ohtani is still going to be heard from in Game 3 and 4. Keep an eye on that. Steven, you got the Padres as well. What do you make of this beef that's going on?
Yeah, Padres. Give me the Padres all day long. But it kind of reminds me, John, of how the Blazer fans look at the Lakers. Like, the Lakers fans don't care about the Blazers, but the Blazer fans hate the Lakers. And that's what kind of reminds me of the Padres and Dodgers. Now, the Padres are spending more money, and they're trying to act like a big market, as you said. So it's changing, like, right in front of our eyes. And we're almost seeing, not the passing of a guard, but we're seeing the Padres kind of get upgraded to, you know, a bigger market team that's going to spend a lot of money. So I'm all for it. I think it's great. It was kind of shameful what the Dodgers players and their fans did on last night in Game 2, throwing stuff at the Padres. Yeah. And the Padres, you know, they played it up. They were looking and taunting the fans as well. So it was, it's a lot of beef. It's a lot of fun, but it's just postseason baseball. Like, postseason baseball is unbelievable. You know, the game earlier today between the Tigers and the Guardians was really entertaining. Like, postseason baseball is just so much fun. And I just want to hear in Portland. Every time I see it, you know, watch on TV and I look outside, it's a great day. I can see some Portland postseason baseball. But no, give me the Padres, man. I'm all for it. I don't like the Dodgers, the Yankees. Get them out of here.
It means so much. Every pitch, every inning, every out, you know, it's just the stakes are so high. And so when you layer on top of that the Dodgers brand and Ohtani's presence in that series and the threat that, you know, the Padres are the disruptor here, they are the uninvited guest, and you sort of look at this and go, you know, if the Padres can knock the Dodgers out of the playoffs, It spoils everything that Rob Manfred and Major League Baseball dreamed about and won't talk about. So we shall see. The 5 at 5 coming up. Rest of this week, Bruce Barnum on tomorrow's show. Thought it was a crying shame the way they lost that football game on Saturday. I can talk more about that. Trent Bray coming up Wednesday. Dan Lanning on Thursday. We'll, of course, layer in some Ohio State throughout the week. So it'll be a big week of guests. But Steven, Anna's coming up with the 5 at 5 next.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Anna is here for the 5 at 5. Bruce Barnum tomorrow, Trent Bray Wednesday, Dan Lanning Thursday. Who else should we get on the show? John Mateer, the Washington State quarterback. Chip Kelly, who do you want? Tweet at me, at John Canzano BFT. Anna, are you ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
She's in studio. She is ready. Is your hair in a bun? What is that? What are we talking about?
I think.
You don't know.
I don't know. I have to feel the top of my head.
I don't need to do that.
No, it's a high pony. It's a high pony.
Okay. High pony going on. Couldn't tell with the headset. Here we go. Steven's going to cue it up. The 5 at 5.
The 5 at 5. Number 1.
I'm a little intrigued by the coach of the Denver Broncos and the heated exchange that Bo Nix had with his coach over the weekend. After the game, Sean Payton tried to explain their relationship, comparing Nix to Ferris Bueller. He says, there's still a little bit of Ferris Bueller in this player that we got to get rid of. He says he is talking about Bo. I love him to death, and sometimes it is my love language. He continued to explain, it is funny. Ferris is kind of quirky and doing his own thing once in a while. He says he's still got a little Ferris in him. He explains that there are times when you send something in and then I don't want it flipped. It gets flipped, but it's all good. He works his tail off. Help me read between the lines here.
Well, I think he's got to explain why they were caught on camera yelling at each other. And Bo Nix was yelling at Sean Payton, out of character for Bo. But, you know, the Broncos are doing this while winning a game 34-18 over the Raiders. Maybe it's just the Raiders rubbing off a little bit on the Broncos. But I think it's Sean Payton trying to get the Howdy Doody out of Bo Nix. I would say more Howdy Doody than Ferris Bueller. You know, to get some real emotion and get some fire out of him and, you know, get him to Mason Crosby during the game as Bo is calling an audible. He starts yelling across at Bo. Bo, they can't hear you. The opposing, you know, defensive lineman. And so I think he's trying to grow him up and trying to get a little bit of a competitive edge out of him. And, you know, Sean Payton knows what he has in Bo Nix. I thought he had one of his better games in this game, which is really weird to me that he ends up yelling at Sean Payton. So I think you could say this, as long as you're winning, you can yell at each other on the sideline. Once you start losing, it becomes a different conversation.
Number two.
All right, let's talk real quick about Robert Saleh's update on Aaron Rodgers. He was seen limping around over the weekend in London in the loss to the Vikings. He said he was able to finish the game and that afterwards it was a light sprain on the ankle and he did hear noises when he fell to the ground. Mind you, Aaron Rodgers, 40. Saleh says he's dealing with a low ankle, but all the preliminary stuff said that he should be fine and good to play next Monday night versus the Bills.
Well, he threw a pick six, threw three interceptions against the Vikings. Now, the Vikings are good, but I think there's some questions right now about how much of the blame Aaron Rodgers deserves and whether or not this is a case of maybe it being the Jets around him or is Aaron Rodgers aging out? And I think those questions are there until he puts them to rest. So, I think he's not playing well. And so when you're the quarterback and you're not playing well, it's on you. But I think in the end, Aaron Rodgers will always be able to point over at the Jets and be like, it was the Jets.
What do you make of the Jets, John? Are they a team that can be spicy by the end of the year, or are they just kind of in the middle of the pack?
Hinges on whether or not Rodgers is Aaron Rodgers, doesn't it? I mean, but don't you feel like that's the thing? Like,
I agree, but what I mean, do you think he can get back to that point? Because I mean,
I don't know. Tell me if it's his. Yeah, you know, it's not like they're 0-5, okay, and they're in the AFC East, where despite their struggles, they're a game behind the Bills. So, you know, there's a lot of 2-3 and 3-2 going on in the AFC right now.
He just hasn't been good. His age, come off the injury. I don't see it getting much better. Like, he might get a little better, but I don't see it getting a lot better. I don't think the Jets are anything special this year.
If he were a younger player, though, I'll play counterpoint to that. If he were a younger player, you kind of go, who he is. Yeah. But if we know that Aaron Rodgers has got that savvy veteran in his game, and so if anybody could kind of figure that out, I would say a guy like Rodgers could figure it out. But there are a lot of questions in the league right now. The Niners are having trouble in the red zone. They're 6 out of 12 scoring touchdowns when they're in red zone situations. It's last year, I think they only had 6 times where they didn't score in the red zone. And, there's questions about Christian McCaffrey, how valuable he is to them. You know, look at the NFC South. It's like 3-2, 3-2, 2-2. Nobody quite done, but nobody running away with this stuff either. Aside from maybe some of the obvious contenders.
Number three.
The Tampa Bay Buccaneers are getting out of Florida. They are traveling to New Orleans early. They'll be leaving tomorrow for their game against the Saints 5 days later. This is because of Hurricane Milton, which has strengthened to a major Category 5 storm today as it rolls across the Gulf toward Florida's west coast, as if Florida needed more. It's still recovering, obviously, from Hurricane Helene.
Well, got to leave early in order to get out. Will that affect them? They're going to New Orleans, and I guess they got the hotels. I don't know if this affects an NFL team the way it affects a college team. We'll find out. But good weather update and more evidence that the real world kind of goes on in the background of the NFL. Like, hey, we got to get out early. See you guys. Batten down the hatches. We'll be back after the football game.
Number four.
In a category I like to call rich people games, Luka Doncic reveals that he won $100,000 from the Mavericks' Derek Lively II on his wild full court shot. He had bet lively about this full court shot at the Fan Jam event on Sunday. It was a $100,000 wager. And I don't know. I hope Lively took out some insurance on that. Doncic makes $43 million this season. Lively makes $5 million. It's not a small amount of money.
Lively lost $20,000 more than the median American income on a trick shot by Luca.
If you're Luca, though, you don't take that money, do you?
There's principal involved. Blazers used to have gambling in the back of the team plane. And Bonzi Wells and Dale Davis and those guys would say $10,000 would change hands in those card games while they were in the air. Now we're talking about trick shots and $100,000.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's a trick shot. Like, if you're gambling, that's like, you know, playing poker, playing cards, doing whatever you want. Like, that's different, but just doing trick shots, I don't know. Be a better leader, Luca.
Maybe Luca forgives him, but then, you know, that then he loses all his cred in his locker room.
Number five.
What are there tons of fights, dude?
We got Monday Night Football coming up.
I want to talk Blazers.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on, Steven.
Sorry, I tried to take over the... I don't like Anna coming back. I'm trying to take over the segment again.
Speak when spoken to.
Goodness. All right, I got to end it with this giant graphic. It's a hilarious graphic that FS1 has debuted in the playoffs, where they're basically just marketing the heck out of Shohei Ohtani. They have a graphic now that says... he is how many batters away? So, like, Shohei Ohtani, two batters away. Shohei Ohtani, three batters away. They understand the audience that is only tuning in to watch Ohtani. And now there are all kinds of memes of this. People have photoshopped it to say six batters away. They have placed the graphic onto video of the presidential debates, the vice presidential debates, the new Joker movie that is out. I mean, it's become a thing.
The Ohtani worship has gone too far.
The Ohtani worship.
The interesting thing is, the first thing that popped to my mind is that the NFL should do this with Taylor Swift, and they should put a camera, they should put a timer on the thing going 3 minutes and 20 seconds until we show Taylor Swift again.
Yeah, just give us a countdown.
Yeah, and then maybe she should pop on every 5 minutes.
Oh, that's going to be a thing.
That should be a shot. The Taylor.
If they're paying attention, they're going to be doing that.
And then they could have a sponsorship of it. They could sell it to, like, you
know. How do they not already have that
Timex,
sponsor?
Timex, the Timex Taylor Swift countdown.
There you go.
5 minutes till Taylor appears.
Right.
Goodness. Hey, we have to cut away. Look at Taylor in the box. Now we go back. It goes back to 5 minutes, you know. If we're going to do it for Ohtani. Steven, you got thoughts on that?
The mic is off.
I did it to him earlier in the show too, because I was trying to stay moving.
Yeah.
Because we had three guests and a shortened show because of Monday Night Football coming up.
Cutting him off all day.
And I said, hey, we'll get back to you later. Never came back to him.
Steven, your thoughts, 10 seconds.
Steven, you want to have the last 9 seconds of the show?
Yeah, I got lots of takes for the whole week. Let's keep it locked in. BFT, Ball Pace Radio Network.
We're back tomorrow.